A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on October 8, 1995, in the series Good News, entitled No One Need Despair. The scripture readings are 2 Kings 7, verses 3 through 10, Romans 11, verses 25 through 36, and Mark 1. Verses 40 through 46. The texts for the sermon are 2 Kings 7, verse 9, Romans 11, verse 32, and Mark 1, verse 45. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
The story that we will interrupt is from the circle of stories of the prophets Elijah and Elisha. There are the writing prophets, and we have their writings in the Hebrew Scriptures, but Elijah and Elisha were great prophetic figures in Israel's history. They confronted the kings in the name of God, and there were many miracles that happened around their ministry. In the present context, the king of Syria has set siege to Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom. And the siege has gone on long enough to where there is famine, intense famine, and the situation in the city is desperate. And outside of the city, there are four lepers. They are outside of the city because lepers cannot be allowed in the city because they are ritually unclean. And therefore, they are starving outside the gate while the city is starving inside the gate. And that's where we pick up the story. Now there were four men who were lepers at the entrance to the gate, and they said to one another, "Why do we sit here till we die? If we say, 'Let us enter the city,' the famine is in the city, and we shall die there. And if we sit here, we die also. So now come, let us go over to the camp of the Syrians. If they spare our lives, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall die." So they arose at twilight to go to the camp of the Syrians, but when they came to the edge of the camp of the Syrians, behold, there was no one there. For the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses, the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, "Behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Egypt to come upon us." So they fled away in the twilight and forsook their tents, their horses, and their asses, leaving the camp as it was, and fled for their lives. And when these lepers came to the edge of the camp, they went into a tent and ate and drank, and they carried off silver and gold and clothing and went back and hid them. Then they came back and entered another tent and carried off things from it and went and hid them. Then they said to one another, "We're not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now therefore come, let us go and tell the king's household." So they came and called to the gatekeepers of the city and told them, "We came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there was no one to be seen or heard there, nothing but the horses tied and the asses tied, and the tents as they were." This is the word of the Lord. The lesson from the epistle, Romans and the 11th chapter. "Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved, as it is written, 'The deliverer will come from Zion, he will banish ungodliness from Jacob, and this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins.' As regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forebears. For the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable. Just as you were once disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, so they have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may receive mercy. For God has consigned all to disobedience, that God may have mercy upon all. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are God's judgments and how inscrutable God's ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been God's counselor? Or who has given a gift to God that he might be repaid? For from God and through God and to God are all things. To God be glory forever. Amen. This is the word of the Lord. And the lesson from the Gospel from Mark and the first chapter, this story. And a leper came to him, beseeching him, and kneeling, said to him, "If you will, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched him, and he said, "I will be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him, and he was made clean. And Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once and said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to the people." But he went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news, so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in the country, and people came to him from every quarter. This is the Gospel of the Lord. When I was a youngster, I grew up in the shadow of a chemical plant that had chemicals for the paper industry in Kalamazoo. My dad was a plant superintendent. Since he was a boss, I had free run of the place. And part of the ritual of my day was to watch the switching on the railroad tracks. There was a track behind our house. There's a track in front of our house also that saved me from growing up with the inferiority complex of growing up on the wrong side of the tracks. But the old engine would puff in and puff out, and the train cars would go in and out. And occasionally, because of our proximity to the tracks, there'd be a knock on our door. And there would be a gentleman there. Now, in the insensitivity of my childhood, I didn't call him a gentleman. I called him a bum. Are there still bums? Bums were, every kid knew what a bum was. A bum was a homeless person, I suppose, without food. I imagine they were the people that, maybe they got as many meals as they could at the Kalamazoo Rescue Mission and then hopped a freight car for Grand Rapids and went to Mel Trotter. But as a child, I distinctly remember the time that my mother would make a sandwich and give a cup of coffee to this gentleman. He could have it on the back steps. I also remember some discussion of the adults in my life that one had to be somewhat discreet about how many sandwiches and cups of coffee one gave out, because apparently the word got around. And you certainly didn't want your home marked out as a soft touch for gentlemen in need of sandwiches. I was reminded of that, thinking about this message, because we're talking about the gospel, about the good news. And the gospel, in Greek, euangelion, is the word for evangel. The evangel is the good news. An evangelist is one who tells the good news, proclaims the good news. Evangelism is that activity of the church in the proclamation of good news. And so I was reminded of an Indian scholar, a Christian leader, who was trained in the universities of England, D.T. Niles, a very fine writer, who in the context of India wrote about evangelism and defined it as one beggar telling another beggar where he found bread. Now, that's a pretty good definition of evangelism. First of all, it puts us in our place. We're all beggars. And we all need bread. And to proclaim the evangel, to tell out good news and glad tidings, is that one who is hungry has found a place where that hunger was satisfied. One beggar telling another beggar where he found bread. That, of course, reminded me of this fascinating story in the book of 2 Kings, the four lepers outside the gate. Now, we know that in the biblical parlance, in that Hebrew society, leprosy was more than a disease of the nerves. We understand what it is today, but at that time it had a moral connotation, and it made one ritually unclean. The rabbis said that one who contacted leprosy was like a living corpse, and to be cured of it was equivalent of a resurrection. And those who had leprosy had to call out on the approach of any person, unclean, unclean, lest they be touched and thereby pollute the other person. They were cast out of the city, out of society. The circle was drawn, and they were on the outside. The lepers were a pathetic lot. But in this story, they may be diseased, and they may be morally unclean, but they're rather pragmatically, humorously down to earth. They look at each other. The city is under siege. No bread. Desperate straits. If you read a little earlier, even the king's wearing sackcloth. And really, kind of atrocious stories. So they look at each other. They say, if we go in the city, we die there. If we stay here, we die here. Are there any options? Well, we could try the enemy camp. If they receive us, we live. And if they don't, well, we but die. And so, they desert to the enemy, as it were. But in the meantime, in the twilight zone, the enemy has heard the hoofbeats of horses and the rush of chariot wheels. And they surmise that Israel's king has contracted with the neighboring kings to bring an army against him. And so the sieging army flees, leaving their tents, not picking up their belongings, leaving their animals, Can't you imagine these four lepers stealthily making their way to the edge of the camp only to find no one there? They poke their head in the tent. My goodness, clothing, silver, gold, food. They gorge themselves. They take all they can handle. They go out and they bury it. They go back and try another tent. They gorge themselves some more. Grab all the loot and go with it. Kids in a candy shop. And then they look at each other and say, you know, this isn't good. This is a day of good news. And we keep silent. And so they went and proclaimed to the city, these beggars, that they had found bread. And the city was spared. Well, that reminded me of the story of Jesus healing the leper. The added dimension there was that Jesus touched the leper. And we know that that is so symbolic of the ministry of Jesus, that he touched the leper, turning convention on its head, daring to do the unthinkable in his radical proclamation that no one need despair because no one is excluded, cut out of the circle of God's love and care. The central symbol of his whole ministry was his table fellowship, eating with all sorts and conditions of humankind, to the dismay of those who were living according to the ritual requirements of the established understanding of the day. Jesus touched the leper so that he need not despair, but rather experience transformation and healing. Well, in Mark's gospel, the scholars tell us there's such a thing as the messianic secret. It's sort of Mark's literary endeavor to keep the fact of Jesus' messiahship quiet to the end. But and so we have already in this first chapter, we have Jesus saying to this healed leper, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody, right? What do you do when something happens? It's good news. What do you do if your life has been rescued, transformed? What do you do if somebody has touched you and communicated to you the accessibility of God, the nearness of God, a God full of mercy and grace? What do you do? Well, you do what you can't help doing. You go out and tell people. It's good news, after all. When good news happens to us, we can't wait to tell it. We can't wait to tell it to our best friend. We can't wait to tell it to the person we meet on the street. Hey, good news, have you heard? That's really what gospel is. And in the early Jesus movement, that's exactly what was happening. That's why they called it gospel, because people babbled it all over everyone they met. This was an amazing new understanding. The old conception of God, the old religious restrictions, the writing out, all of that suddenly took on a whole new understanding. And the Jesus movement spread like wildfire. Spread like wildfire across the ancient world. Paul wasn't converted to God. Paul wasn't converted to religion. Paul wasn't converted to faith. Paul was serious. Paul was a blue-blooded Jewish believer, zealous, committed, devoted, a Pharisee. Paul was converted from religion to grace. And when he had the experience, He spent the rest of his life expending all of his energy going to the ends of the earth to tell people about it. His conception of things was just 180 degrees from everything that he had learned in his well-loved tradition. He never despised the covenant. He says in one context, "What advantage then has Israel? Much in every way to them was given the covenant and the fathers and the ordinances and all of that. What a blessed position they've been in." He couldn't understand why they didn't see it the way they saw it. As Steve said, maybe Paul would have said, "Don't you see it? Don't you see it? Can't you see it?" He was so excited about it. He believed it with all of his heart. His life was poured out in an offering because he so believed that the eternal God, the creator of all, had drawn close in Jesus Christ and that there was grace now. Why didn't his brothers and sisters see it that way? He couldn't figure it out. He wrestles with it, Romans 9, Romans 10, Romans 11. If you want to see a Christian struggling to understand through all of the contortions of thought, follow Paul through Romans 9, 10, and 11. But when he comes to 11, he at least comes to this. He said, "I don't know why Israel is blind to this. Maybe they're blind to this so you Gentiles could get the light. And maybe now you getting the light will drive them through jealousy to come to the light as well, so that finally, the conclusion of this will be that all have been disobedient in order that God may have mercy on all." You see, that was revolutionary. It was enough to energize that man to pour out his life for the rest of his life with passion in order to speak good news. It was good news. Well, something happens eventually in things religious. The second generation doesn't quite feel the heat, see the brightness. Pretty soon it tends to be a hand-me-down experience. And then organization takes place, and institutionalizing, and forms and structures and professionals, and before long, evangelism becomes a matter of bringing people into the institution. And that original blush is lost. And I'll give you another image for evangelism. I haven't preached on evangelism in 25 years here. I haven't called you to be witnesses in 25 years. This is the only church I know that back in 71 called a minister of evangelism and never structured a program of evangelism. Gord was our minister of evangelism without a program for all those years. And the reason is this: that original blush of amazing grace that causes one to babble it everywhere, even if Jesus says, "Don't say anything," one can't help oneself. One tells everybody. One is so excited about it. It is so natural. It is so normal. It is so contagious. Now becomes one more obligation. Now hear this image. If the image I affirm is one beggar telling another beggar where he got bread, this image is one that I would not use because I think it conveys the posture of the church. That conceives of evangelism as calling to a family in a house that is burning to alert them that they're on fire and they better get out to save their hide. In the early years of my ministry, God forgive me, I think that's the way I preached evangelism and the way I called people to Christian witness. Do you feel the difference? One beggar telling another beggar where he got bread? Or someone standing on the outside of a burning house with a family in it telling them they better get out because the house is on fire? Do you feel the difference? The one draws a circle that embraces the one to whom one is speaking. The other draws a line and says, step over the line and be ye saved. Come and join me, be like I am, become a part of my institution, and then all will be well with you. When, as a matter of fact, the gospel in its first blush, the gospel in its power, the gospel in its magnificent, persuasive, undeniable, joy-filled attractiveness is a word about something that is already true, not something that you must do. It is a word about what God has done. It is a word about the nature of God. It is a word about the nature of grace and of mercy. It is a word about something that is true. It is true if you know it or not, and you can't do anything about it. That's the amazing nature of the gospel. That's when people get excited, when suddenly they hear in the midst of their despair or their lostness or their guilt or their fear that they can just relax, because underneath are everlasting arms, and over them the shadow of the Almighty, and there is grace enough, greater than all our sin, and there is mercy enough to overcome all our alienation. Religion is rotten, folks. We need to be converted and saved and turned from religion. Religion is controlling and manipulative. Religion is guilt-inflicting. Religion is full of threat and warning. And there are so many people, particularly those of us who have been raised in it and so sensitized to it. We feel that compulsion to perfection. A really religious person is like a child that can never satisfy a demanding parent. You can never do enough. You can never do enough. You can never do enough. And finally we catch up with ourselves. Finally, I know that compulsion to perfection will never be realized. It will be a monkey on my back all my days. I come to the end of myself. I come to a dead end. I come starkly to face myself in the mirror, and I know that there is so much there that will never wash. And then I can stay in the church and get beat over the head with, or I can just get outside of the hearing of the word and try to deny all of that that I know is here. I know what I'm talking about. I can remember the day, the time, the moment, and the place. In the midst of the disaster of my own life when I had failed badly. And all of that nurture All of that compulsion to perfection. All of that came crashing down around me as I realized that I was fallen. And a good friend pulled out a chair. He said, "Kneel down." I knelt down, put his arm around me. He prayed. And he didn't pray with a line between us as though somehow or other. It was something I had to do to get on the other side of the line. With his arm around me, he made me, for the first time in my life, who had preached and preached and preached and preached, he made me feel grace. And I'll love him forever for it. And it was the thing that transformed my ministry. It is the thing that has transformed this congregation. 25 years, I've never said go out and witness. But maybe it's time that I do call you. Because you see, out there are all kinds of people in your neighborhood, the people you work with, and like Tillich says, in those beautiful words that Bob read with us, the emptiness, the meaninglessness, the sense of failure, the despair. When it comes over one, one needs someone to put their arm around and to say, "You are accepted. You are accepted." Don't say anything. Don't do anything. Just rest in the fact that you're accepted. Maybe I should suggest that it's time for you to go out and speak that. You can speak it so naturally, so easily, so gently, because you see, you're not telling the people they're in a house that's burning down. You're telling the people that they're in a house of grace already. And there is nothing that will transform a human personality like the experience of grace. So Christ's community is like Sam Shoemaker says of his own ministry. It's a ministry at the edge where folks who are blind and weary and despairing are groping to see whether or not there may be any hope. And we stand near the door so we can take the hand and guide them in. And we stay near the door because sometimes coming in, they may fear and flee again. And so we don't call them to anything, but just to receive the grace of God. And receiving the grace of God changes everything. Dear God, isn't that good news? Isn't that good news?